Welcome to Questions That Matter. This is a podcast of the C.S. Lewis Institute, where we dive into discipleship of the heart and mind. And my conversation partner today is Samuel James, who has written a really, really helpful and important book called Digital Liturgies. I'm going to let him explain that title in a bit. Samuel is one of the acquisitions editors at Crossway. He's written this book I mentioned. He also writes an online newsletter, Digital Liturgies. The subtitle is important, Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in an Online Age. Samuel, welcome to Questions That Matter.
Thank you, Randy. It's great to be here.
So you've written a book about how digital technologies, the internet, texting, all of it, you put it together. You do make it clear that we're talking about different things, and yet you're trying to talk to them as a whole and how they make a difference. Your introduction is what the web means for our spiritual lives. So tell us, at least just in a short bit of a nutshell, what does the internet or what does the web mean for our spiritual lives?
Yeah, it's a great question to start with. I kind of begin in the book with just the realization that modern life is almost entirely mediated through internet technology. It's not difficult at all for a modern person in the developed West to do their reading, to obtain an education, to kind of maintain relationships, to shop, to get things, to have all their entertainment in a stationary position, just from the comfort of their couch. Mm-hmm. That is modern life as we know it. And life, when it becomes mediated through a certain technology, that technology begins to exert a great amount of influence over how we understand our lives. And so when we think about what the internet means to us as Christians, as people of God, we have to wrestle with the fact that all technology, and this was the point of writers like Jacques Ellul and Neil Postman and Marshall McLuhan, all technology presses onto us an idea. Simply by virtue of technology's existence, it tells us that these kinds of things that we can do through this technology are good things to do and ought to be done. And these technologies create worlds in which certain ideas and values are plausible by virtue of the technology. And that's just the way technology works. That's not necessarily an evil thing at all. That's simply the way culture responds to technology. But where we have to reckon as Christians is with the fact that the internet is unlike the wheel or unlike a jet engine, in that the internet is what Nicholas Carr calls an intellectual technology, a technology with language, a technology that can actually speak back to us and shape how we think. And so if that's true, then we need to interrogate how the internet might be affecting how we think of God, how we think of ourselves, how we think of each other, how we think of our place in the world. And I think it's exhibiting an enormous amount of influence on how we answer those questions. And so really, there's really no part of modern life that the plausibility structure of internet technology has not in some way kind of influenced the way we think about it. And so the book is trying to kind of peel back the layers on that to kind of expose what are the issues that the internet has kind of left its imprint on us, and how does that compare to the wisdom that we see in Scripture, and where there is a dissonance between those thought patterns, what does the Bible point us toward for the way of recovering the Christian way of understanding these things?
You know, I really hope our listeners caught the repetition of your word "how," because that's what your book is saying. It's how does technology shape us and affect us? Certainly, there's a whole lot we could talk about of what the internet is telling us and what messages we're hearing from social media or TikTok or texting or whatever. But you address those things too, but you're more concerned about sort of stepping back and how the very medium of technology, the very medium of the fact that right now you and I are not in the same room. We're not even in the same state. I think we're in the same time zone, which has another effect, but we could talk about. But so you and I are connecting and we're having a conversation. And that's different than if we were sending each other emails back and forth. But it's still very different than if we were sitting in a coffee shop with the same exact environment around us and all that. So say more about that, of the how. How does it shape us? How does the fact that we connect with people through electronics, how does that make an effect on us?
Yes. So the basic nature of the internet is that it's a disembodying medium. And what I mean by that is that the internet is a technology that kind of divorces us from our bodies, from our physical location, and it enables us to kind of mentally enter into a space that could be anywhere. So this sounds very technical, but it's self-evident. It's obvious. I can log into my email account and write emails to people who are living across the world in Australia or China, and they will receive that in real time and get it. I could open my phone and do FaceTime with someone who is on the far side of the world. Technically it's tomorrow evening where they are, and we could have a live conversation. Those abilities depend on the idea that there is a part of me that is divorceable from my body. I am giving my attention. I am giving my language. I am giving my kind of virtual presence to a space that is independent of my body because I don't have to be there. And so the primary way that the internet influences us, and again, I haven't even introduced the categories of good versus bad. This is not what we're talking about to this point. The primary way that the internet revolutionizes our thinking is that it makes us feel disembodied. We do not interact with the world online as embodied people. And this is why, whether it's a FaceTime with a friend across the world, or whether it's activism on social media on behalf of a cause that is completely remote to us and doesn't affect us, and we don't know anyone involved, yet it feels very passionate to us, it's the same effect being played. And so what the internet invites us to do, but simply by virtue of what it is to think of ourselves not as people who are tied to particular places, who have particular physical identities, who have particular characteristics, but to kind of digitize ourselves into online personas that are not limited by time, space, or physical appearance. So for example, I can actually control online what other people see of me, of my person. Sure. I can choose what photos to upload. Uh-huh. I can choose what filters to apply to those photos. Even in a video situation, I can manipulate the lighting, or I could kind of shift the view of the camera so that you see exactly what I think you should be seeing, what you see of me, what I want to reveal to you. And that's significant because according to scripture, there is only one being in the entire universe, the knowledge of whom is entirely dependent upon his self-revelation, and that's God. And so the internet almost has this godlike impulse in all of us to kind of control what image we project to other people. And that is at the foundation of every digital liturgy that I talk about in the book, every way that the internet is spiritually shaping us. At rock bottom, it's this kind of digitization of the self. And this feeling, this sensation that we get from the practice of being online that our existence is completely manipulable, that we can kind of curate what we consume, that we can control how others see us and what we see of the world. And it's these attitudes that bring us into these ways of thinking, these ways of feeling, these ways of speaking that are distinctly internet shaped.
There's a couple of phrases you've used that are so packed with implication. So we are digitized selves, and there is this temptation, because we control things, for us to sort of imbibe a kind of godlike sense of power. You know, not too long ago, I was telling a friend about something that I was watching on television that I really liked, and he said a really odd question. He said, "When is it on?" And I thought, when is it on? It's on when I want it to be on. It's on, I mean, I record it and then I play it when I want to. In fact, I don't even need to record it. I go and search and find, and I think I want to watch it at 10:47 p.m. on a Tuesday. And it does, but it didn't hit me until that moment when he asked it. It's like, oh, that has an effect on me. I control reality. I'm old enough to remember that when you said, when is it on, what that meant is, you better watch it when it's on, or it's gone, or you missed it.
That's right.
There wasn't, I mean, this is even before recording possibility. So if it was on Thursday at 7, you arranged your life around Thursday at 7, because that's, and that's not nothing. That's not minuscule. That does have an effect on how we view ourselves, how we view reality. By the way, I have to jump in and quickly tell my listeners, because I think some people may be thinking, boy, these guys sound like, you know, two crotchety old men complaining around, yeah, when I was a kid. Well, so I'm certainly one of the old crotchety old men. I'm 67, but Samuel, who I'm talking to, is 34, a mere youth. Mm. And so he's concerned about these digital liturgies. Let me just tell people a little bit about the topics you go after. There's five, I guess you're calling them liturgies, but there are five ways that this technological world shape us. And you go after categories like authenticity, outrage, shame, consumption, meaninglessness. I don't want to delve into all of these, because I want people to buy your book and read it. How does this technology push us in a direction of meaninglessness? That's towards the end of your book. How does it point us or move us in this direction of meaninglessness?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think probably most of your audience can relate to the sensation of, whether it's on your phone or on your tablet, this, you know, catching yourself after being on your phone or your tablet for much longer than you intended to be. Hmm. And you kind of have like a waking moment where you think, I don't even care about what I'm looking at. I don't know how I got here. I'm just scrolling.
Yeah,
I'm just I'm kind of lost in the internet jungle, mm-hmm. with no compass, and I am trying to kind of wake myself out of it. I think that's not, you know, so many people have had that experience. I absolutely have, and I've spoken to so many people. In fact, the vast majority of people who think with me on these issues have had a similar experience. And I don't think that just happens to be something that we all have in common. It's crazy how we've all had the same experience. Mm. I actually think that is a reflection of the technology itself. That is somewhat what is intended to do. It is intended to kind of immerse us with the sheer force of novelty. Mm. I think of all aspects of the internet that probably go underappreciated in simply their sheer strength to shape us, it's the novelty of the internet. It's the fact that I can literally refresh the page of social media, or I can go back to Google, or I can plumb the depths of search pages or YouTube, and I can occupy myself all day, every day, for as long as I want, finding new things. There's always something new. And I think the net effect of that has been kind of a sense of soft despair. The sense of that there's never a break. There's never kind of this sense that, hey, we're content now. You know, just the other day I had, you know, what experts have referred to as phantom phone vibration syndrome, you know, where you have your phone in your pocket and you think, oh, somebody texted me, and you get your phone and nobody texted you. You didn't get a notification. That's literally an example of how kind of our brains are being rewired by this constant novelty that we expect and we consume on a daily basis. And I think what that does, Randy, primarily, is it puts us in a situation where we're constantly putting our attention span towards somewhere else other than where we are. We're constantly thinking of things that people have sent us, or the latest controversy, or the latest influencer, or something like that. You know, whether it's Instagram, and we're kind of comparing ourselves to these perfect people with these perfect families and perfect looking vacations. It's the sense that we're not really at peace, because we're never really completely there. We're never present. We're never fully present wherever we are. And you know, a lot of parents listening to this can probably relate to some, you know, convicting moment where they've been on their phone, or they've been on their computer, and they've snapped just in enough time to hear their child say, "Mommy, mommy," or "Daddy, daddy." Mm. And it's clear that they've been calling for a few minutes, but we've kind of blocked it out.
Yeah.
Our attention span and our emotions and our thoughts are constantly being pressed, not thinking about people we know that are just far away, but thinking about this general place of content called the internet. And so I think meaninglessness for me in the context of the book simply refers to how exhausting it is to have our sense of attention, our sense of burden sharing, so spread thin by this kind of amorphous place called the internet. I'll give you one personal example, because I think this kind of drives it home. So a few years ago, my wife and I were looking on Instagram, and there was a particular person on Instagram who was kind of this, you know, content creator, and their daughter had a traumatic accident and was going through, nearly died and had emergency surgery on her brain. And so for the next year, they posted updates almost every day about their daughter who was recovering from this traumatic brain injury, but who would never be the same because of cognitive damage to her higher brain functions. And for almost a year, we were just wrapped up in this story about this couple and their daughter, and wanting to see updates and feeling the despair at a bad day and feeling the hope at a good day that they would post about. And there came a day where I just turned to my wife and I said, I can't do this. Like I can't share this burden with them, because there's no relationship there. I can't reach out and minister to them. They can't come into our life and open up with us. We're not actually walking with them. We're simply spreading our emotional energy in the direction of this kind of internet space. And it's causing this grief that I can't do anything about. And I think a lot of people listening to this can probably relate to something like that.
Yes.
So that's kind of what I was going for with that chapter.
I want to talk to you about our fellows program. It's I think the core of what we do at the C.S. Lewis Institute. And I'll start by asking a question. Do you desire a deeper relationship with Jesus and also with other believers? Do you want to experience the power of a transformed life? Well, since 1999, the Fellows Program has helped transform the lives of thousands, really thousands of people. And it has been commended by pastors and many other ministry leaders because of the dynamic impact that it has on individual people's lives and their local churches. The C.S. Lewis Institute Fellows Program offers a year of intensive discipleship that leads to significant life change. Unlike some other discipleship programs, the Fellows Program focuses on discipleship of both heart and mind. So it involves Bible study and classic readings and lectures and group processing, but it also includes personal spiritual mentoring and accountability, all in the context of a small group of like-minded believers. This year-long program is designed for those who want to live as fully committed disciples of Jesus Christ and who also want to make an impact for him in the world. We have fellows programs now in 17 cities. Please check it out on our website. It's under the Fellows Program, but again, cslewisinstitute.org/fellows-program. Boy, this is so helpful. The phrase you just used a little bit ago of a soft despair, and then just now this insight of I get involved in people's lives, but I'm not really involved. It's a disconnected involvement. And therefore, it's not a real involvement. It's kind of an observer who can't really enter in. And when you contrast that to people's lives that you really are involved in, it has such a very different feel and flavor. It's, oh, no, I'm going to pray for this person. I'm going to tell them I'm praying for them. I'm going to pray with them. I'm going to go over to them across the side of the room after a worship service because I know that someone in their life just died and they must be hurting. I'm going to put my arm around them. I'm going to say, I've been praying for you. That's so different. And it's real. I want to get to, all right, so what do we do? Because, I mean, after a while, this could be kind of sort of despairing. We might despair of the despairing anyway. But you have a really, really beautiful transition. I know everybody's wondering it, so I'll have to say it. No, Samuel does have a phone. I know. I emailed him earlier to confirm this kind of, and he got back to me right away. So I thought, oh, he's really on his phone all the time. So your solution is not forget it, throw all the technology away. It's not possible. And you very powerfully point out that really wouldn't solve the problem because the problem is in our hearts. But you have this beautiful paragraph I want to read because it contrasts the digital world to what you call the gospel's analog truth. You write, one of the great things about being a Christian is that in a listless and frantic age, you don't have to chase after every new idea or attitude. To be a Christian is to go to bed every night knowing that you have a completely trustworthy, completely solid, and completely good word from the creator of the universe. The maker of the stars put the wisdom, truth, and hope we need in a book, the Bible. The Bible reveals to us the grand narrative, the master story that gives meaning and direction to our lives, the gospel of Jesus. That's so important for us to make the bedrock of our lives. It is finished. It is said. It is stated. It is declared there for us. And now I can connect with people and I can even use some technology, but that world, the digital world, is not the foundation of my life. The foundation is the finished work of the cross and the finished work of God revealing his word. I just love your insight about that. How have you seen that play out in your own personal life of walking with the Lord?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I think as I've been thinking and researching and praying over this topic, what has floated to the top for me has been the recognition that kind of digital immersion, so like trying to kind of lean into a lot of the things that we've been talking about with regard to the digital space, there's always a motive there. There's always something in the heart that's going on whenever I'm wanting to kind of consciously retreat into social media or hide from people by hiding behind technology. And often those motivations are boredom because I'm not actually fulfilling the responsibilities that the Lord has given me. Sometimes it's fear of what other people will think of me and the need to kind of control what they see of me. Sure. Sometimes it's anger and frustration that this person on the internet is wrong and I have to get on the internet and correct them or they're just going to run rampant over the world with their wrong ideas. Those heart stages precede this digital immersion. Mm. And so for me, the primary thing, honestly, that leaning into the wisdom of Scripture has meant is that I am interrogating these emotions according to the gospel. So when I'm bored, the gospel says, actually, I have given you a purpose. Jesus Christ has given me a purpose, and his purpose on my life is for me to glorify him, to make disciples, to teach them to observe everything that he has commanded me, and to spread the knowledge of Christ throughout the earth. So what part of my life needs to be given to that mission right now to kind of alleviate this listless anxiety that I might have in this moment? If I'm feeling fear of how other people think of me, well, that is rooted in not understanding that it's God's opinion of me that matters the most, that it's my heart that matters the most before him. And he is the only one who can actually grant me the validation that I crave. He is the only one whose well done and good and faithful servant really matters. And so that reorients me. And then if it's anger, then the Lord actually takes that anger in the gospel away from me and says, I'm the righteous judge. Mm. If you see sin, if you see wrong things out there, you can trust that I will repay. I take vengeance. I'm a God of justice, and you don't have to take the virtual sword, quote unquote, of truth and try to hit people over the head with it, because I am the righteous judge and I can do a better job of that than you ever could. And so that relinquishes the power of anger from my heart. And so in terms of practically, what do we do? Well, we start with the gospel. You start by immersing yourself in all the ways that the gospel addresses these kind of digital delusions. And then you take practical steps like, hey, do I just need to step away from this particular app or this particular website for a season so that I can learn how to recalibrate myself toward reality? Do I need to bring in somebody who can help keep me accountable, who can ask questions like, hey, like, you know, I saw you post something that was kind of weird and kind of angry. Like, is that okay? I don't think you should be posting that. Bringing other people. My phone, I actually have limits on my phone that my wife has the password for. She has the password for my social media accounts. And so I have to have her help to get in. And that is a wonderfully liberating thing because that actually it not only provides a buffer between me and, you know, very addictive technologies, but it also lets her in the loop. She knows what's going on. Okay. And Randy, I think one of the most powerful things about our modern technological age is the sense of privacy and isolation that these technologies, all of us are walking around with a phone that is deliberately the size of one human hand. And that's what it's meant for. It's meant for a solitary single person. Uh-huh. It's meant to isolate us from each other. And so we need to apply the gospel in very explicit categories to not just how we think about technology, but how we use it. But it's possible and it can be done. And it doesn't require getting in a time machine and going back to 1993.
I'm sorry. I'm just struck with how funny the phrase of time machine and 1993. I mean, you're like, really? You'd go back that far? I was thinking of 100 years, but no. Again, I sometimes feel like in these conversations I have, I want to underline certain things. And so you said, I think the way you worded it was I use the gospel to interrogate these emotions as opposed to, and then a little bit later you talked about digital delusions. So you disconnect from the phone and you stay in the very heart of the reality and you try to look at that reality of what's going on inside you, what's going on around you, through the lens of God sent his son to die for sinners, for me. So I want to try to get to a few practicalities. By the way, I'm just reminded, and no, I'm not required to always quote C.S. Lewis in every one of these things, but I just can't help myself. But I remember reading that Lewis never wanted to write using a typewriter. Now, I know for some of our listeners, you'll need to go look on the History Channel to find out what a typewriter is. But because a typewriter made too much noise. And he said that prevented him from hearing the words as he wrote. He wanted to hear the sound of the words. And so he didn't want clouding or preventing him. So he wrote things out longhand on a piece of paper, which didn't make any noise, so he could hear the words. And I love that insight. It's looking at the technology. Mm-hmm. How is the technology shaping what I want to communicate? But so let's talk about a couple of practical strategies, just a few. I think your book has quite a few suggested. I'll start with one for me. I try to do this more often. I don't do it anywhere near as often as I should. But when I'm waiting somewhere, waiting online, waiting in an office, a doctor's office or something, there are times that I choose not to take my phone out. And say, no, I just want to be in this line. I want to look at the other people in the line, the other people in the room. I want to look at the environment, what's going on. I'm paying attention. Because when I take my phone out, well, now I'm not really in that room anymore. I'm wherever this is. I'm wherever the story or the whatever. So, and I have to tell you, it feels weird. Because it's like, well, no, I'm just being here, observing. Not a whole lot that's happening. This isn't terribly entertaining, but God in his sovereignty has chosen that I would be on this line right now with these particular people. And if I remove myself, I may be missing some opportunities that he has sovereignly placed me in. So what are some, I don't know, very practical strategies you might suggest?
Yeah, well, one thing that is a blessing is that there are actually technologies that exist to help us push back against technology. So there are, subscription-based apps that I use, like Freedom. And, you know, Freedom is a very powerful kind of wall that you can put up on your computer that will, you know, block social media for predetermined sets of time. And I find that to be a very helpful measure to simply kind of recover the art of concentration and the idea that I want to focus on one particular thing without constantly feeling the pull to, okay, I'm reading something or I'm working on something for 10 minutes, get up, check social media, go back, you know, try to maintain this very, very hard to balance mental distraction. So that sort of thing is a practical thing. But I honestly think, like, for most people listening to this, probably the best thing they can do is to commit themselves to going to church every week, to not watching the live, not just watching the live stream. If you're physically able to go, to be part of a local church and to put your phones on do not disturb or turn them off, and honestly just rediscover how life-giving it is to be among humans. And when COVID happened and the world kind of shut down and everything went online and everything kind of relocated to the live stream and the computer, part of me thought, I wonder if this is a good thing because people will get really sick of all this and they'll think, hey, I really want to be back in attendance and I want to just rediscover human interaction. Unfortunately, I don't think that happened. I think people got hooked on the kind of emotional protection that a screen can give you.
Yeah.
The protection from vulnerability that an online persona can give you. But really it's soul sucking. It's so exhausting, and it's nowhere close to what the Lord has created us for. So I think most people listening to this, if they just committed to going to church this coming Sunday, that would be such a positive step in the direction of reality, in the direction of embodied community. And then just kind of run from there, get lunch, you know, call people, don't just send them an email, you know, pursue friendships, not just followers. You know, that we call our virtual friends, but what they really are is a virtual network. They're not really friendships. We're the loneliest generation in American history, and yet we have the most reach digitally of any generation. And that's because online friends are not the same as in-person friends.
Yeah. I think I've said this on this podcast a number of times, that one of the most important things for me in going to church is it is filled with strong reminders that I am not the center of the universe. I'm
absolutely
in a room with all these people who are very much like me, in that we're Christians, but they're very different from me, different ages, different lifestyles, stations or whatever. Sometimes they make announcements about parents with young children, and I think, oh, this doesn't apply to me. And then they make announcements about people who are interested in this. And it's great that there are things that don't apply to me. It's like, oh, I'm part of a community where talking about, that's really, really important for them, not so much for me. So I'm going to pray for those people. I hate this, but I love it. We almost always will sing at least one song that I don't like. And it's great. It's important because, this isn't about the Randy Newman curated list of songs that are best for him. I'm part of a community that, okay, that particular song actually connects well with some of those other people. And that's really, really important for a self-absorbed narcissist like myself. It's weakly getting set free more and more from that I'm the center of the universe.
It's so well said. And Lewis has this great observation that, you know, it's one thing, we all pray in our rooms, you know, Lord, help me to love other people. And then when it's easy to love other people in the abstract, it's easy to love the thought of other people. And then when you're sitting in a pew and that person over there, like you don't like the way they voted, and the person over here, like you don't like the kind of thing that they wore today. And the gospel is telling you, no, here's your chance. Like, this is what loving other people means. That is such an important spiritual practice.
Yes, 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 yes. Oh, I remember in the Screwtape Letters, you talked about the guy with the squeaky boots at church.
Yeah.
And I laugh every time I'm at church when somebody does anything that could fit into the category of squeaky boots. It's not squeaky boots. It's whatever it is. It's like, oh no, I need this. I need this. Well, maybe this is a good place for us to draw it to a close. We're giving C.S. Lewis the last word. That seems to be appropriate on a C.S. Lewis podcast. Samuel, you've written a very, very helpful work for us, and I'm going to put links in the show notes for people. Give us a short little commercial here at the very end about your newsletter. How is that distinct or different from your book, and how can that be helpful for people?
Yeah. So if you go to digitalliturgies.net, you can find my Substack newsletter, and I send out regular posts about technology in the Christian life, but also about books and theology and just what it means to be a follower of Christ in a modern world. So I hope some of your listeners will find some of that material helpful.
Great. That's great. Well, thanks again for the time. And to our listeners, thank you for the time. Thank you for tuning in to a digital production of something about how we need to consume digital media more meaningfully, more with biblical wisdom. We'll put these some links in the show notes. Check out other resources we have on our cslewisinstitute.org website. As always, we hope all of what we do helps you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind.